broadcasting live from South Texas. This is your Petardcast. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, ready to walk through hell on the 4th of July to bring you an obscure chuckle of recognition. Tonight is our third episode, and we'll be joined by guest star, Mr. Calamity John Morris, a product of a comics-tainted youth. He'll be appearing in a work of comedic something or other with me, and playing another exciting and offensive round of J'accuse. In addition, we'll be bringing you more tidbits, a round of naming of parts, and of course, more delightful audio glitches for your home collection. So please join me in finding the humor in tragedy, and the tragedy in humor, on tonight's Petardcast. We're going to start off once again with some excerpts from Tidbits, my long-running advice column in the New York Times, which contained little bits of guidance for young and old to get through the muddle of life. It was canceled in 1989 due to an upswing in the phenomenon of political correctness, as well as the introduction to the Times of a sexual harassment policy. By the way, there will be a book of Tidbits coming out just in time for your holiday shopping, pending a judge's decision. When I die, I hope to come back as a bird, so I can fly around and shit all over those cocksuckers down at the bus station. The kid who works weekdays at the tobacco shop was telling me the other day that he's sick of having people stare at him like he's some kind of freak. I told him that maybe he shouldn't have dyed his hair green and put those metal do-whats in his eyebrows. I think he spit in my pipe tobacco after that. How come when someone gets in a horrible accident and loses both legs and an arm and an eye or something, there's always some asshole who says what a blessing it was that the guy wasn't killed? It's not a goddamn blessing, for Christ's fucking sake. The guy doesn't have any legs and has to crack it with his offhand, and that's a blessing? Maybe what God is saying is what a curse it is he didn't die. Did you ever think of that, Churchy? Have you ever gotten mad at someone who's sucking your dick? I haven't, but I guess some people do. Different strokes. There's this weird sensation I get sometimes when I'm driving. It's like all of a sudden I can't tell the difference between the brake and the accelerator, and I can't tell how far away the other cars are, and I swerve a lot when I think my hands are steady on the wheel. Maybe I'm getting Alzheimer's or something. The only thing I know for sure is that it tends to happen when I've been drinking for several hours. I don't know why people are always trying to get out of jury duty. Well, you like your fucking job that much? Try being sequestered just once. You'll never want to go back. Sometimes you'll hear about a murder case, and it's like they'll go out of their way to be horrified that the victim was shot 16 times, or stabbed 47 times, or decapitated and the head was eaten, or something. I don't understand this. Who gives a shit? It's not like the guy's any less dead if you only shoot him once, so why not have a little fun with it? You're probably not going to get a chance to do this very often. I know if I stabbed some guy to death, I'd really go to town on the body. Enjoy yourself, I say. I'm working on a book about which presidents had sex during their terms. Actually, it's not so much a book as it is a napkin. The fuck is the problem with sleeping all day? That's my favorite thing in the world. And to hear people talk, it's like I'm goddamn Hitler. You don't see anybody yelling at a cat for sleeping all day. That's the problem with the world today. Not enough people yelling at cats. When somebody asks you what you do for a living, what they're really asking is how much money you make. A good way to get them out of your business is to tell them that you do something where nobody knows how much it pays, like investment analyst or advisor or some bullshit job like that. I mean, shit, I hang out down at the DMV drinking dime chicken soup out of the machine, but that doesn't mean I'm not a consultant. It's time once again for a round of naming of parts, which is a feature where we go through the filmography of one of our favorite screen actors and take a look at the names of the characters that they played over the years. What do we gain from this? Absolutely nothing. It doesn't give us any kind of insight or any kind of critical perspective on their career, any psychological information about them. It's barely even what you'd call trivia. But I'm guessing if you're listening to this podcast, you don't have a lot of other pressing demands on your time. Today on Naming of Parts, we're going to look at our first actress, one of my very favorites, Sigourney Weaver, star of stage, screen, and television, one of my favorite actresses of the 80s and 90s, a classy dame, and the subject of a very intriguing bit of poetry by Robert Downey Jr. Sigourney Weaver got her start some time ago, and her filmography is filled with some pretty interesting names, as we will see in just a moment. They do tend to follow the predictable patterns, though, and we are going to reiterate the rules. No animated characters or voiceovers. No playing yourself. That's no playing yourself. Let's get that clear. And we're also going to avoid any kind of speculation about the actual role itself, because I don't have time to watch all these movies. I already watch about 14 movies a day on average, and it's exhausting. Sigourney Weaver has not played a lot of people who are things. In one of her very first roles, she played Alvy's date outside theater in the great Woody Allen film Annie Hall. And she played a therapist on an episode of Eli Stone. Who doesn't remember Eli Stone fondly? But that's it for playing people who are things. She's only played a few people who are first names, Joan, a Linda, and a Vicky. But she's played a few people who have no first names, but only titles. Mrs. Lawson, an Aunt Ramona, a Warden Walker, and then in a big step up, Queen Isabella I. Well, the role was a big step up. The movie was 1492, Conquest of Paradise, which was a big step down. One odd thing about Sigourney Weaver's career, and this may go hand in hand with being named Sigourney, she's played a lot of women whose names sound like men. She's played Eleni, which I appreciate because I'm always down for somebody who's played a character with the geeky name of Leonard or a variant. She's also played a Tony Sokolaw, a Rex Brooks. I've never met a woman named Rex. And in an upcoming film, she plays a character named Mike. I don't know what that's all about. She seems like a perfectly feminine lady to me, but she plays some tough guy roles, so maybe that's the only way in American culture that you can signify the presence of masculine qualities like toughness or resilience is by giving your female character a man's name. Good work, screenwriters of America. Sigourney Weaver has played her share of generic wasps, as have all American actors who are not non-white. She's played a Helen Hudson, a Sandy Travis, a Laura Wheeler, a Marshall Lawton twice in two TV movies based on John Cheever stories. Way to raise the bar, Sigourney Weaver. Mary Griffith, a Deborah Morehouse, Dana Barrett, of course, her legendary role in the beloved Ghostbusters series. Two Catherines, one with a K in Working Girl and one with a C in Deal of the Century. A Jill Bryan, a Jessica Fitzgerald, and a Janie Carver. Two Alices, Goodwin and Hunt. An Eve, an Ellen Mitchell. You thought I was going to say Ripley, didn't you? And Ellen Ripley, of course, her role in Aliens. Ellen Ripley being pretty tough for a generic wasp-sounding character. She's had her share of quirky characters. A Baby Paley, a Chaffee Bickness. That's a good one, Chaffee Bickness. That sounds like some kind of criminal slang, you know, like, hey, he's up all up in that Chaffee Bickness. And a Daisy Quimp, which is pretty good. I don't know if it's ethnic, but as you may suspect from looking at her, Sigourney Weaver has not played a huge number of ethnic characters. A Gwen DeMarco and a Paulina Escobar is about as ethnic as she gets. She also once played a character named Avis Ryan, which I can't decide whether that's just quirky or straight out strange. And finally, she's played two people who have fancy titles, both doctors. Dr. Lauren Slaughter in Half Moon Street, which is based on a novel named Dr. Slaughter, which is something I happen to know because that's just the kind of Robin that I am. But my question is, if you have a book that's called Dr. Slaughter, why would you change the movie to have the title Half Moon Street? I mean, what's going to do better at the box office, Half Moon Street or Dr. Slaughter? I know who's going to go see, who's going to sell more tickets. Dr. Slaughter, that's it. And she also played Dr. Grace Augustine in Avatar, which I haven't seen, so just shut up about it. Once, she played a character who had three names in Heartbreakers. She played an Angela Nardino, which is fairly ethnic, an Olga Yevanova, which is super ethnic, unless you're Russian, and Max Connors, which is also goes in the women whose names sound like men column. So here's looking forward to more Sigourney Weaver roles, because, man, I have a feeling that before she dies, she could play at least 50 to 100 more extremely genteel patrician wasps. Keep up the good work, Sigourney. We love you. From time to time here on the Petardcast, we like to bring you news from the greater world of culture. And today is one of those time to times. The discovery in a South Korean hayloft of a new edition of Shakespeare's plays has sent a lot of shockwaves through the academic world. It was brought to light by the renowned Pohang-based scholar and beet farmer Kyungil Jang, and judged to be authentic by the North Texas All-American Theatrical Verifiers Association. It's going to be a groundbreaking collection, I think. It's believed to have been personally edited by the Bard in 1609, shortly after the death of his mother. It's being referred to as the Sedesimo edition, and is eagerly being pored over by professors and critics alike. Although official publication of the Sedesimo is not scheduled until April 26th of 2014 to coincide with the playwright's 450th birthday, the owner of the materials, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, has generously allowed this podcast an early glimpse of the comedies and a taste of what lies in store for us. What has changed about the plays of the canon, what surprises await us in this first new edition of Shakespeare's work since the quarto of 1623? The answers will shock and delight you. In the Comedy of Errors, Dromio of Syracuse is now named Dromio of Melton Mowbray. Conversations between Luciana and Antipholus have been replaced with a long string of curse words in Latin. Act 4 of Scene 2 has been removed, and an anti-Catholic League propaganda leaflet has been inserted in its place. In Two Gentlemen of Verona, the play is now titled The Two Colossal Assholes of Verona. The plot now hinges on an extremely detailed discussion of Mantuan tax policy. Valentine and Proteus dress in ape suits for most of Act 1. In Love's Labour's Lost, Longueville has been changed from character of the play to the setting of the play. Don Adriano de Armado is referred to in the dramatis personae not as a fantastical Spaniard, but rather a fantastical retard. Holofernes is brutally decapitated in Act 4, Scene 2, by a previously unseen character named Judith. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, all characters are openly referred to as homosexuals. A lengthy anal sex scene between Bottom and Snout takes up much of the first half of the play, and Robin Goodfellow has inexplicably become the King of Sweden. In The Merchant of Venice, the action of the play has been moved to Verona. Antonio now wishes to open a fast food hamburger chain in Italy. Shylock, Jessica, and Tubal are all beaten with whips and sent to a concentration camp run by a character named Lartin Muther at the end of the play. In The Taming of the Shrew, an endnote suggests that John Cleese would make an awesome Petruchio. Kate's shrewish nature is now attributed to a foul odor rather than bad temperament. And the play concludes with Bianca marrying Lucentio's servant Grumio. In Much Ado About Nothing, Dogberry's role is now that of a straight man. Don Pedro and Don John are the same character, and most of their dialogue consists of one actor standing alone on the stage and yelling bastard to himself. The play ends after six pages. In As You Like It, the play is now titled As You Like to Like It Live. The middle section of the play involves Charles showing various all-in wrestling moves to Frederick while shirtless and smeared with duck fat. A line in the dramatis personae previously reading a person representing hymen has been crossed out and replaced with a doodle of a penis. The Merry Wives of Windsor, Abraham Slender, now referred to by most other characters as Abraham Fatass. Shakespeare's endnotes suggest that for matinee performances, a lucky audience member be chosen at random to write his or her own ending. The play has also been retitled The Merry Wives of Stepford and concerns itself with the replacement of Mistresses Ford and Page with robotic duplicates. In Twelfth Night, or What You Will, Orsino is now both the Duke of Illyria, the sea captain, and Viola's brother. Sir Toby Belch displays many other gastrointestinal problems. And Sir Andrew Aguecheek is now the hero of the story, which concerns the smuggling of a rare pestilence which must be stopped within 24 of the clock. Troilus and Cressida is now no longer a comedy but a drama. Additionally, the play is no longer Shakespeare, but a word-for-word duplication of Homer's Odyssey. Most of the last three pages of the play are unreadable due to the presence of what are thought to be fried chicken stains. All's well that ends well. Shakespeare's endnotes include the inscription, "Well, I really gave away the end with this title, didn't I?" The action has changed from France and Italy to Egypt and Ethiopia. Touchstone the Clown from As You Like It makes several cameo appearances, reading his same lines from that play at confusing moments. Measure for Measure is now called Measure for Measure for Measure, Two Colossal Assholes of Verona 2. The action has been moved from Verona to Venice. The announcer is told to check thy local listings for the debut of Master Shakespeare's next great play, Henry V, Henry IV, Part 2, Part 2. Pericles, Prince of Tyre. All characters other than Thasia, daughter to Simonides, have now been eliminated. Play is three times as long, and Thasia now reads the entire play verbatim as a solo performance, saying the other characters' lines in funny voices. Cymbeline, the main character is now referred to as Thumbelina. Iachimo, now entirely identical to Iago, and spends much of the play railing against injustices he has suffered at the hands of Othello, who is not in the play. Shakespeare's endnotes call for an all-midget cast. A Winter's Tale. The play has been reimagined as an experimental performance piece which takes an entire winter to perform. Characters are eaten in the order in which they appear, and is now the first Shakespeare play to feature regular musical numbers. Finally, The Tempest. Prospero's books are all about carpentry, and the entire play takes place in an elaborate treehouse fort he has constructed. Caliban, rather than scheming against his cruel master, merely complains about the poor quality of his level. The action has been moved from a desert island to a small coffee shop in Verona.
Okay.
All right, welcome back to the Petardcast. I am joined by our second special guest, and a very special guest he is at that. I'm speaking with Mr. Calamity John Morris. How are you, John?
I'm doing very well, Leonard. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. It's Halloween, and I've decided to go dressed as a guy who works from home and doesn't need to change clothes every 5 days or so.
Oh, is it fair to say that this is your costume?
I'm going as a different guy.
Yeah. Someone you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, tell us who you are and what you do.
All right. My name is John Morris. I'm a cartoonist and illustrator and sometimes writer living outside of Seattle, Washington, recently transplanted from Arizona. And if you know me from anything, if you know me from anything, you know me from the internet, Leonard, because we've been on it for years.
I know you from this phone call.
Yeah. Well, you know me from a lot of ways. You slept on my couch several times.
That's the least of what I did on
your couch. Oh, my gosh. I so thought you were dying on that thing. But it turns out it was just paroxysms of joy and or the attempt to respirate.
Yep.
Anyway, if anybody in the world knows me for anything, it might be for the Ignatz-nominated webcomic Jeremy or for the often replayed This American Life episode where I basically called 3D Man a dick.
Good times. What have you been doing lately to which people should be paying attention?
I am a special hidden guest on occasional episodes of the Wasted Words podcast, which is overseen by last week's Petardcast guest, RJ White.
Surprising how many people have not figured out that...
Well, let's not, you know, kayfabe.
All right.
It is shocking, including the number of people I personally know who have no idea who I am on that show.
Exactly.
I'll tell everybody, I'm Tony Zarrett.
Okay.
Oh. I sneak in there as Tony Zarrett. And then I do occasionally write for Heavy.com, which is like a slightly less tasteful Maxim. And I've written... Oh, God. More fart jokes and pictures of tits.
Nice.
And I also occasionally write for... I don't think we're doing this anymore, but I used to write for RJ White's City Desk blog, which was the Journal of the Imaginary City, which you also wrote for.
On hiatus, I believe.
On hiatus. Yeah, it would be nice if it came back. I don't know if...
RJ seems to every once in a while get a bug to do it again, so I think we'll...
Yeah, can we use this episode of the Petardcast as sort of like a bully pulpit, and we'll just drive him, either shame him or just force him to get back
doing the City Desk? Story. Like, he's got so much else to do.
Yeah, and why are you so anti-Semitic? I just thought I'd throw that in there to raise the stakes.
That's
RJ, why are you so anti-Semitic? And bring back the City Desk.
Yeah. I mean, I think the City Desk served as an outlet for his anti-Semitism, you know?
That's true, and I think that it would get better if we had the City Desk back. RJ, that we're doing this for you.
Right. Yeah. And you live in the Seattle area. I think you actually live in Redmond, right?
I do live in the city Microsoft built, yeah.
What's the deal with Seattle and Redmond and or Redmond?
Are you trying to find the relationship?
No, I just want you to talk about it. I want you to give me an impressionistic portrait.
Here's the relationship between Seattle and Redmond, as I understand it. We are in a bar in a district of Seattle called Ballard, which is sort of an artsy hipster kind of community. And in the restroom of the bar, among the other graffiti which is written there, was somebody had written "Die East Side Yuppies." Because obviously there's one thing that Seattleites hate. It's sort of formless, meandering wealth, mm-hmm. which is why it was totally appropriate that graffiti was in a bar that totally serves a gentrified neighborhood full of 20-something graphic designers.
Right. One of whom surely wrote that graffiti.
Undoubtedly. It's undoubtedly some just like very angry 24-year-old kid with Elvis Costello glasses and a full beard. Mm-hmm. And like a check shirt, and he's got a scooter, and he's got a train pass to Vancouver,
and he designs little animations for, you know, Outlook.
he designs like Expedia logo stuff, and just hates yuppies so much because of their young urban professionalism. This young urban professional. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the relationship between the two cities. Redmond itself doesn't really have a personality so much because it's just a place where everybody comes to work for the most part and then goes away. We are in this we're in this really nice locus though, because we've got the urbane Seattle community just about 10 miles away, and then we have the incredibly racist kind of dirt farmer personality about another 10 miles away further west.
Yeah, you're kind of right on the edge of where crazy Washington begins.
Yeah, there's some beautiful towns out further east of us, and we love driving around them and visiting some of the shops and such out there, and then passing the farms where people have spray-painted on giant planks of plywood anti-socialist messages about Hitler, Obama. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, when I was up there, I saw a lot of those heading out of town, you know, because that's the route I took, you know.
Yeah, because they want you out of town well, is basically why they have it there.
Yeah, well, they were lucky then, because that's just what happened. I left town to head for the truly socialist wilds of Western Canada.
Did you get some socialized medicine while you're up there?
Well, you know, actually, I was in pretty good health, but I wanted,
there's no reason not to. Yeah, get
I
some.
I wanted more. To get some free socialized medicine, so I, you know, kept trying to crash my car or, you know, fall off of a cliff or something, but it just wasn't happening. Luck was not on my side. I did get some Canadian beer, but it wasn't quite as good as Canadian medicine, I think.
Is Canadian beer like Canadian bacon in that it's flat and round?
Yes, it's
that's fantastic.
It's much like American beer, except slightly more expensive.
And I think it also has a certain bragging right attached to it, which we don't. Mm-hmm.
Did I ever tell you about the beer store?
Hit me with the beer store.
The beer store in Ontario, you know, the Canadian government runs the liquor stores. And one time I was visiting a city in kind of, you know, rural Ontario, and I wanted to go get some beer, so my friend stayed behind and checked us in at the hotel. And I said, oh, I'll go to this place. I saw this place called the Beer Store. I'll go get us some beer. And I thought that was just the name of a shop, you know, but it's actually the title of stores run by the Canadian government that sell beer. It's called the Beer Store. There's also the Wine Store, you know. And there's some law, or at least there was at this time, which was, you know, probably 3 or 4 years ago, so I'm sure it's still the case, that you can't actually have the beer out on display. So when you walk into it, it looks like a store that sells, like, beer paraphernalia. There's, like, beer t-shirts and posters and bottle openers and, you know, just, like, things associated with beer, but there's no actual beer. And
it's like a store for people who are really big fans of beer.
Right, that's exactly what I thought. I was like, if I stumbled into, like, a beer memorabilia shop or something. But there was a big poster, like a, not a poster, but like a message board, you know, with little plastic letters on it.
Sure.
In the counter, and it had all these names of beers on it. And, you know, feeling like the moron that I was, I kind of timidly asked the guy behind the counter, do you sell beer here? And he's like, yeah, what kind of beer do you want? And I said, I don't see any beer. What kind of beer do you have? And he just, like, pointed at the sign with all these names of beers on it. And it turns out they keep all, the law requires them to keep all of the beer in the back. And then when you order it, it comes out on a little conveyor belt.
What?
Yeah. So, like, if you say, give me a six-pack of Labatt's Blue, the guy, like, says six-pack of Labatt's Blue into a little microphone. And then a little conveyor belt, a la I Love Lucy, rolls out.
And I fully expect, like, the music of Raymond Scott to play and two little robots just assemble your beer bottles for it. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, that's pretty much one, the way it works, yeah.
One falls off the conveyor belt and a little robot with a whisk broom comes along and just brushes the glass into himself.
Yep, that's pretty much it, you know, except instead of a robot, it's an, you know, an underpaid Toronto, you know, Ontario slacker, you know. Guy who dropped out of school, you know. But he does hum that song, you know, as he comes to do it. It's part of the job.
You have to do something to pass the time. Mm-hmm. And you also have to watch out in case two mischievous mice get in there and start pushing all the buttons to make them work.
Exactly.
I'm really trusting a lot of people to have seen this very obscure Warner Brothers cartoon.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we can count on, of the five people who are going to hear this podcast, that at least two or three of them have seen it, so... All right, well, let's get to playing a round of Jacques Hughes, in which I ask my guests to defend a historical atrocity with which they played no active part. So, John, I'm sure probably sometime, maybe back when you were in school or as part of your casual reading, you may have heard about the Holocaust.
Yes.
Also known as Shoah... and that thing that got us Israel, I think they also call it that.
Right. It's often referred to in terms of the get. Right. Yeah.
this would have been, you know, the series of events during and leading up to the period of World War II, where the Germans decided that the Jews of Europe had just been a thorn in his side for too long, and that he would solve the Jewish problem, as he termed it, by murdering them all. And so he killed 6 million Jews, a pretty substantial number of Poles, gypsies, homosexuals, time travelers, fitness enthusiasts. Probably
you would have thought they'd be okay with the fitness enthusiasts, but no.
Well, you know, it was mostly the show offy ones who would do it outside,
like joggers. They got joggers,
right? You know, and the guys who like look at themselves in the mirror when they're lifting weights and go, "Oh yeah,
yeah."
Yeah, those guys. You know, I think they're probably the ones who most people think had it coming the most.
You know, we just don't talk about them enough. I really think that's an oversight of history.
Well, you know, everybody's happy to be rid of them, you know.
That does explain why sometimes I'm at the gym and when guys are lifting, you hear them go like, "Never again! Yeah. Never again!"
Right, yeah. So my question is this, John.
Mm.
What are you personally going to do to make up for the Holocaust?
I think here's what I can offer about making up for the Holocaust. I think I can recontextualize it into a love story.
Really?
Yes. Now you
like
may know
like sort of a.
I think like a timeless love story,
comedy maybe, or.
I think what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to really narrow focus on the Holocaust. So narrow that in fact we don't focus on it.
I see.
Now, as you know, my father is German.
That's right.
And was born at the end of World War II in Darmstadt. Mm-hmm. And his parents, both of his parents, and just so you know, his mother and his father, both of his parents, were members of the Nazi Party.
When I was preparing for this podcast, I began writing a Tom Waitsy song for your appearance that began with the line, "His father's a kraut, my father's a drunk." But I couldn't think of a next line, so.
Does anything
about consigned to the dustbin of history that idea?
How about his father's a kraut, my father's a drunk. What you gonna do with all that junk in your trunk?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I like
it. It takes it in a sort of non Tom Waitsy direction, but
no, true. It gets a little black eye Tom Waitsy's, but I think this will be a good theme for the romantic structure that I'm trying to build here.
Right.
But I think we should instead look at like the Holocaust in terms of these two people. They were experiencing exceptional poverty. My grandmother and my opa and oma were experiencing extreme poverty before the very lucrative field of genocide was opened up in German industry, and that gave them the capacity. My oma was actually her family in World War I were baron. I guess they weren't all barons, but her father was a baron, and he had land, and he had like all the little things of wealth you get with being a baron. And then the Treaty of Versailles just squashed that. I think we all agree it's a cruel and unfair treaty.
Yeah, that's French.
Yeah, utterly, utterly unfair. It removed all of their wealth, and she became a very poor person. And then her family really had to struggle. And then Gunther, my opa, was himself from sort of rough circumstances. And so the party gave them the ability to really replace themselves in society. And he was able to you know, get a prominent military career, which ended gloriously in Northern Africa. Mm-hmm.
Did it end permanently in Northern Africa?
It also ended permanently in Northern Africa. It didn't end permanently because of his death. It ended permanently because he was sort of cannily cowardly.
I see.
At the end of the war, he stripped out of his Hauptmann's uniform and put on the uniform of a dead private.
You've just lost the sympathy of all our Nazi listeners.
I'm sorry, but they'll get back when I talk about my grandmother, because she legitimately hated Jews. So I'm sure they're going to like that part. But he dressed as a private and then tried to give himself up to the Brits, and the Brits wouldn't take him. And he tried to give himself up to the Americans, and the Americans wouldn't take him. And they all told him, if you're a captain, and then they said, "Why don't you try giving yourself over to the Russians?" And he just thought, let's not do that. He just walked back to Germany.
Yeah, that turned out not to be such a good move for a lot of Germans.
No, it turns out, but they seem so friendly, and their Zangief is such a charmer. But anyway, so but that enabled them to like get out of the rut of poverty. That gave my grandfather the impetus to really begin a career that has taken him on some terrific experiences. He's had a rich and accomplished life. And like I say, my grandmother really, really hated Jews. So that was a wonderful outlet for her. And together they came together and they fell in love and they made love. And through their love, they brought into the world my father. I think that's a lovely story. And I think we can just recontextualize the Holocaust in the sense that it brought a lot of people together and created a lot of love.
It did. So you're arguing essentially that the death of millions of people in concentration camps is worth it as long as you truly believe in love.
If modern Hollywood romantic comedies have taught me anything, then yes. I honestly think this story is probably only about 2 years away from becoming a Jennifer Lopez vehicle.
Well, you know, they did, what was that Brad Pitt movie? The,
Inglourious Basterds?
No, the English Patient.
Oh, okay.
Wasn't the guy that was based on really kind of a fairly vicious Nazi, you know, or collaborator or something, and then they thought, you know, yeah, but it's such a romantic story, you know?
Right, but on the other hand, he's quite a looker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, yeah. That's, you know, that's the whole problem with Nazi Germany, is that they, you know, they had Hitler in charge, and he wasn't that great looking.
No, he was.
They put one of the more handsome guys in charge, you know.
Like whom?
Oh, what was the blonde butcher? What was his name? The guy who was assassinated in Prague. The guy they always held up as the paragon of, is this young, handsome, noble-looking guy, and I don't remember his name, but, you know, that's the problem, is that all these World War II leaders, you know, I mean, Mussolini kind of had that big, fat, football-shaped head, and,
right.
You know, Tojo was just, well, he was Japanese, and, you know, those
people. Yeah, you know, I all my understanding of what he looks like come from the covers of Captain Marvel and Superman comics. So
he had those giant eyeballs, and you know,
right.
And you know, he's about 4 feet tall, and you know, he was always being chased around by a cartoon mouse. You know,
right? Or he was just getting his butt kicked, and then his little ass was up in the air, and then his boots were like around his ears. Yeah.
Whereas the Allies had really handsome leaders like Churchill.
Right. Who, as I understand it too, used to have his meetings, some of his war meetings, in the bath. He would just be in his tub.
That's a good image.
Imagine if you had to seriously discuss British losses of life to that.
Mm-hmm. Probably it got all the generals eager to get back out. And
that's true. Yeah. For God's sake, let's get back to murdering someone. Yeah.
All right, well, that's well defended. I'm sure that the
thank you.
The Jewish people are rethinking the whole thing.
I'd like to apologize to my godparents, Barney and Ruth Sugarman, right now. I love you, Uncle and Auntie Barney and Ruth.
But it's a valiant effort, and you know, I'm sure that history will eventually turn towards your argument.
And I think love is inevitable.
This is the first step in complete reassessment.
All the Holocaust museums are just going to turn into Love Is museums.
That's right. It's going to be two little naked 6-year-old cartoons of your grandparents. One of them, and he'll have a monocle.
Right.
All right. Are you ready to do some dialogue?
I'm ready to do. I'm so warmed up for dialogue. It's unbelievable.
All right. Let's do some dialogue.
Yeah.
Kirk, could you come into my office for a moment, please?
I'm working on this PowerPoint presentation, Jake. I have 6 o'clock deadline.
It'll only take a few minutes.
Okay, Jake. Hey, you go to game this weekend?
Kurt, I really don't... It's hard to say this, but... Well, your services are no longer required.
What?
We're letting you go, Kurt.
This make no sense. I've been spokesman for company over 60 years.
To be honest with you, Kurt, that's part of the problem. You've been on the staff for 6 decades. We thought you'd have moved up by now. You seem to lack ambition.
I no lack ambition. I first green-skinned corporate mascot in American history. Why I being punished for enjoying job I in?
Well, Kurt, it's not just that. be honest with me. Weren't you kind of hoping for this? And don't you want the chance to move on? It seems that way to me. Your attitude lately suggests that you're not happy in your job at all.
What you mean, Jake? Listen, I still say slogan good, hmm? Ho, ho, ho! Ho, ho, ho!
I know the slogan, Kurt. We all know the slogan.
Plus, me still green and giant.
But you're not very jolly. You're downright surly. There's no place in this company for a surly green giant. You never seem happy anymore.
I'm happy when the peoples eat corn and peas and green beans.
And what about when they don't? You threaten them. Last week at the opening of the new Ralph's in Topanga, you said you would club a 9-year-old and grind his bones if he didn't try the new Fiesta Blend vegetable mix.
Ah, that make me jolly. Many ho 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 I say that day.
We can't have your jolliness coming at the expense of our customers' lives. There's just no place for you in the organization today.
Where I go, what I do, I have Sprout to support.
Kurt, if you want my advice, you should tell Sprout to get a job and move out of the house. I may be overstepping my bounds, but that kid is 39 years old, and his performance art career is going nowhere. My father, a pistol's journey? People don't want to see that.
I still need job. I need make living. Social security not enough for Green Giant. My food intake, prodigious.
Look, I really shouldn't do this, but I know a guy, William Morris, I could put you in touch with. He's always got theatrical work for people like you.
Like what?
Well, there's Trek on Ice. You'd be perfect for
that. Not diminish me, Jake. I'm serious actor.
Hey, I'm trying to help you out, pal. If you're going to be a dick about it, you can just go clean out your desk right now.
You not even give me second chance?
I can't do it, Kurt. We're in a financial crunch, and everybody's getting hit hard. Why, even up here in the executive suites, we've lost, well, nobody I know, but I hear the night janitor was cut back to only 30 hours a week.
One time in 72, old marketing VP tried to lay off Jolly Green Giant.
Yeah, what happened?
No one know. Him disappear. Never seen again. You remember 1972, that year when big FDA scandal bone fragments found in frozen niblets? Something to think about.
You get out of here, you big lug. You got a presentation to do. Well, that's it for tonight's edition of the Petardcast. Thank you to Mr. Calamity John Morris, Lion of the Art World, for joining us. His work can be found online at ape-law.com. Join us next week for more meaningless words and questionable deeds, as well as J'accuse, Celebrities Are Our Betters, and another special guest who will make you entertain the notion of spousal infidelity. As always, if you're interested in appearing on the show, email me at guests@ludiclive.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the Petardcast free of charge on iTunes or listen anytime at ludiclive.com. We're always happy to hear from you at info@ludiclive.com. This episode is dedicated to Johnny LaRue and Stanley Kubrick. Thanks to all the bad examples out there who keep me from feeling sorry for myself. I'm your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce. Don't take that tone with me, little mister.